So Gaia, who is Gaia? We're a worldwide alliance of more than 600 grassroots and community-based organizations around the world who have been fighting various forms of burning, incineration. And basically our vision is a just, toxic-free world without incineration. We do two things, broadly. We work with frontline communities who are fighting various industrial burning of wood, of waste, of biomass, of coal, of oil, of all kinds of toxic pollutants in their backyards. We also, in the last few years, have started working with waste workers around the world to promote good jobs, community health, and climate justice. For the last couple of years, we've facilitated the formation of the Global Alliance of Waste Workers. It's a alliance of waste worker unions from around the world, from Asia, Africa, Latin America, with the goal of having the voices of these frontline workers in the waste and recycling sector represented at the UN Climate Forum to help lead the discussion of an international strategy to mitigate today's ecological and economic crisis towards a sustainable and just future. There are millions of these workers around the world, workers whose families are supported by picking, sorting, and recycling industrial and consumer society's discards, as workers whose skills and livelihoods protect the world from a large amount of climate pollution. Their knowledge is necessary for the future of people and planet. Just as the knowledge of those who grow and gather our food, people who build our homes, steward our forests and fish, the knowledge and skills of these workers is essential to guide us out of today's corporate industrial disaster zone. It's the leadership of the working poor, like waste workers, whose labor prevents more climate pollution emitted from burn and bury practices while slowing down unsustainable production. It's this leadership that we need today to reclaim a trash society. Two decades. And this is I threw a bit of a graph in there showing how much climate emissions, how much climate pollution waste workers, recycling workers prevent compared to modern day corporate technologies such as incinerators, landfill gas to energy projects, and other, you know, expensive corporate solutions that are being marketed in the global south, largely by companies in the north. And as you can see, you know, these working poor are preventing a much larger carbon load from coming on board than the best available industrial technologies. So two decades, I put through the slide up there, just random images. If people are interested in knowing who these folks are, we could talk about it later. Connie Hedegaard, who's the EU Climate Commissioner, used to be a CEO of an incinerator firm. The CDM Executive Board, and at the bottom left-hand corner, I believe he was the ex-CEO of PG&E. Some of you may recognize him at the inauguration of the Climate Action Partnership, the folks who gave us the blueprint for the Waxman-Markey congressional bill, climate bill last year. But I put this up there just to demonstrate these are the faces of the people who we are relying on to bail us out of the climate crisis. This is the status quo leadership. And two decades of scientists of science led by such bureaucrats, muzzled by corporate lobbyists, and driven around by carbon marketeers has led to a zero-sum game. Some would call it a 388-sum scenario. But that's where we are today. What I wanted to get at in this presentation is core to a successful pathway, a mitigation out of our current crisis, is looking towards the leadership of the working poor. And to do so, we need to flip the script. We have enough good academic and legal allies and all kinds of great organizations around the world. Now we need to look to the leadership of the frontline workers and communities who are actually preventing massive amounts of industrial carbon from coming on board and showing us solutions with their traditional skills and their work. And this leadership is on the move. I'll go into what we were doing in Cancun a bit. We had representatives of waste worker unions from South Asia, from Africa, from Latin America, converge in Cancun to demand that their rights to their livelihoods and to ecological justice be respected, that their leadership, their skills, their knowledge base on how to sort through society's discards and not burn and bury them and create more climate pollution be respected and be acknowledged in that forum. These folks demanded an end to the financing of false solutions through the carbon markets and the CDM process, financing of incinerators, landfill gas to energy projects, technologies that not only add more climate pollution, but deprive these folks of their basic life resources, public resources, undermine their livelihoods, and undermine, you know, their communities. And these leaders got to have their voices heard. It's been a demand of the larger climate network of climate justice activists for the last decade that we have the voices of such frontline workers and communities represented. And unfortunately, it has been we've been ourselves slow on the uptake on supporting our allies in being at such forums. But this year, or in Cancun, we had a couple of dozen waste workers show up and have their voices heard. And these leaders got to meet with the leadership of other frontline communities, of the International Peasants Movement, of the Indigenous Environmental Network, who were there to have their demands met. Indigenous peoples from both North and South America demanding that false solutions like the RED program, the reduced emissions from avoided deforestation and degradation, not be pushed through as it was, that huge industrial projects like the tar sands in Alberta not be financed and supported by the governments of the North, and that Aboriginal rights to sovereignty and self-governance on their traditional lands be respected throughout these negotiations. And when I say that these frontline communities got to meet and exchange their views, this is very significant, because as we can all imagine, these folks oftentimes don't get to travel halfway across the world to meet each other, let alone fly, you know, across continents. For many of our delegation, this was their first time on a plane. And this is significant, because this is exactly the sort of dynamic we need to be creating. It's not, you know, the best allied policy wonks that we need anymore in these spaces. It's the leadership of these communities and the people who can bail us out of this current crisis that we need showing up at these conferences. Just some images of some of the actions. As folks know, Via Campesina, the International Peasants Movement, called for a day of action. Thousands showed up by bus, by public transportation to Cancun, despite being constrained by the climate forum and the local authorities. People had their voices heard. People got together, people converged, people marched, and people let the world know, you know, where the leadership lies of for a future a sustainable planet. We even had some grassroots community groups from the US show up, and it was the first time that a number of environmental justice and climate justice frontline community groups that have been organizing to fight some of the worst climate polluters in this country were able to get together and show solidarity for the working poor of the world. As I mentioned earlier, the authorities were very successful at constraining public protest. But despite that, a number of our youth leaders who showed up, this is Joaquin from the Youth for Climate Justice, a new formation of youth leaders here in the US. Others showed up and following arrests, following being detained, decided to demonstrate what exactly the UNFCCC means today to civil society. At the end of it all, I was able to come back in time for the Global Day of Action here, and it's significant. La Via Campesina, along with Grassroots Global Justice and various other allies, held dozens of actions across the US and here in San Francisco in the Mission. We got together with members of Mujeres Unidas, Poder, and a number of other community groups and allies of the Mobilization for Climate Justice, and have a community-based action, because this is where climate justice really starts, in our backyards, in our communities, by reclaiming our streets, by linking climate to broader economic and social justice issues. This brings me to climate justice because on my way here, actually, there's also a number of other events taking place in the next few days around climate justice. And on my way here, there was a bit of a discussion with some friends around how different people perceive this term climate justice. And I had to throw up what I have kind of come to kind of define for a lot of groups that I work with as the fundamental tenets of climate justice. And they are the rights, the inherent rights of workers and communities to democratically determine the use of their food, water, and energy resources, to form agreement, collective agreement, on elements of market justice, from how to create local economies, to closed-loop industrial systems, to zero-waste systems that reduce waste, all elements that would support a community-controlled economic paradigm, as well as bail us out of the current climate crisis. And finally, hold corporations accountable for their historic debt to these frontline communities who bear the disproportionate burdens of climate pollution, while shutting down the major corporate polluters in our backyards. It's worthy to know, where do we go from here? What's our current scenario? And thanks for Rose for setting up a lot of the context here, because most folks here are familiar with all the various climate formations here in the US, and we know that a lot of resources were thrown at, in recent years, a DC-centric policy campaign to get climate legislation out of this new administration. Despite the best intentioned efforts and a lot of resources, the strategy failed. We did not get a climate bill. We did not even get a compromise climate bill that had been co-written by industry. Why did this happen? And there was recently a significant climate strategy, national climate strategy meeting in upstate New York. With a number of our allies, national, environmental, and climate groups working on climate issues, and a lot of deep soul-searching to examine why this had happened. And I just, without belaboring a lot of the points, I just want to say some of the most interesting things I heard there were that, the climate movement had failed to get themselves on the national agenda. They weren't even on the Obama's agenda when it came time to discussing critical issues. They failed to reach out to natural allies, including environmental justice and frontline community groups that have been leading a lot of fights against the world's largest climate polluters. They'd lost touch with grassroots activists and frontline communities and hadn't really assessed, you know, their own sphere of influence. A lot of people have used the frame, our movement confused access for influence. Just by being in DC and having a handful of lobbyists in DC, our ability to shift the frame when we're outnumbered 1,000 to 1 by corporate lobbyists representing King Coal and Big Oil and the incinerator industry and all the corporate false solutions was not going to get us anywhere. And so we need to rethink our strategy. However, there's another side to this story. And that is what's been happening on the ground, and oftentimes unheard of because it doesn't get much press, but significant. And that is that community-led climate justice in the US has been winning. The largest amount of industrial carbon that has been prevented in this country has been prevented by community-led groups, by grassroots groups, groups fighting coal, oil, and incinerators. And I'll whip through the last few slides. Communities have been stopping King Coal. From Appalachia to the Southwest, communities have taken it to King Coal, prevented permitting processes, actually prevented some of the largest operators, Peabody in the Southwest, the Navajo and Hopi, you know, successfully through grassroots organizing, stopped the largest Peabody mining permit. We've also prevented a huge number of coal power plants, 145 of the 151 coal power plants proposed under the Bush Energy Plan were prevented largely by community-led groups, groups that have very little funding, volunteer-based groups networked by groups like the Indigenous Environmental Network, by the Energy Justice Network, by the Western Mining Action Network and by supporting each other with very little resources have actually stopped 145 coal power plants from being built in the last 3 years. And this is significant. Due to Desert Rock and other folks in Appalachia. No new incinerators have been built in the US in the last 13 years because of similar networks. Networks that Gaia, Green Action, Energy Justice Network, and the Indigenous Environmental Network have led over the last 12 years. Just in the last year, we prevented about 60 incinerators from being built. Huge amounts of carbon. Each of these incinerators produce more carbon dioxide per megawatt hour than the dirtiest coal power plant. They're also more expensive than nuclear energy, and yet these are being promoted as solutions to current climate legislation. Communities have stopped mega hydro projects. Folks are familiar with the Undam the Klamath campaign. And right here in our very backyard, community-led organizing by great community activists like the West County Toxics Coalition. Henry's here, give him a big hand. The Asia Pacific Environmental Network, Communities for a Better Environment, the Richmond Progressive Alliance, through grassroots organizing, have prevented multi-million dollar campaigns by big oil to stop the expansion in the courts of the largest oil refinery west of the Rockies. So this is where we have had success and where we need to be investing our resources. So what are we faced with? Where do we go from here? We need to be investing in grassroots action at the front lines of climate change, prioritizing local organizing for resilient communities, building trans-local networks that can support each other, both in the US and beyond, and ultimately building solidarity with global grassroots movements. A couple of events that are coming up that people should put on their calendar. Rising Tide is organizing a National Day of Action Against Extraction. And when we talk about extraction, this is extraction of not just coal and oil, but extraction of human resources from our communities, extraction of public resources, extraction of forest resources, agriculture resources, everything that should be in the public domain of control. It's coming up on April 20th. Folks, if are interested in plugging in, can contact my buddy Scott Parkin in the back there. Scott, you want to raise your hand? He's one of our key organizers, so folks can... Yeah. Also coming up locally, 2 days from now, is another community debrief led by the Mobilization for Climate Justice, West County Toxics Coalition, Communities for a Better Environment, and other environmental justice allies in the Bay. We're going to have a look at, it's going to be more of a strategy meeting to discuss how do we organize to build out the movement that we need today. We need to be putting thousands of people, millions of people on the street in this country in order to shift the frame. And I invite you all to join us in doing so. Finally, the most significant thing I heard in the election campaign was that change will not come from DC. It'll have to come to DC. And it'll have to be brought by the leadership of the grassroots. So I think all of you need to be part of that grassroots movement, and I look forward to working with you in building that movement.